This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of September 8th, 2005.
All right, police!
Bad cop.
No donut.
Bad. Cop.
No. Donut.
It's under law, and I rule.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. This week marks the first anniversary of this program. Over the past year, we have featured interviews with authors, filmmakers, lawyers, scientists, journalists, activists, and many victims of police abuse. This week, we will look back at some of the interviews we've featured over the past year. We will also have updates on the stories where we are able to. In April, I spoke with Christian Williams, author of Our Enemies in Blue. The book is a chronicle of the history of police abuse in the United States, which also looks at how the institution itself deals with the problem and how police brutality enforces inequality in society.
The tendency is to discuss official crimes in terms of bad apples and aberrations and people of exceptionally bad character. And it's interesting that sort of characterization runs no matter how high the misconduct goes. So, like, if there's a corrupt cop in the lowest level of some minor police department who's misbehaving, then that scene is just a matter of, like, his own personal bad morals. And looking back on, like, the Nixon years, people tend to think of, well, Nixon was an exceptionally bad person. And we're really encouraged not to think about things systemically. And in general, that approach just has less explanatory value. It doesn't explain why some misconduct is tolerated and others isn't, and it doesn't explain why the same patterns of misconduct reproduce again and again. And it doesn't explain why, it doesn't even consider whether there are features of the institution that these people are part of that shapes the misconduct in particular ways. It's a very individualistic and, in some ways, I think, naive view that bad things happen because bad people do them, and totally forgets the context in which they do them, the ways that they may be rewarded for doing them, or the obstacles that are in the way of doing the right thing. And one of the things that I like to bring up when people say, well, you know, there are good cops, too. I like to think about, well, okay, and what happens to the good cops? What happens to the whistleblowers? What happens to the police who steadfastly refuse to use excessive force or engage in racial profiling? And they tend to be marginalized within departments. And in the case of, you know, cops who turn in corrupt cops, they're often driven out of the profession altogether and sometimes, you know, physically harmed by the other cops. And so, you know, we are faced with this institution that, in many ways, some of them very subtle and some of them very out in the open, rewards the misbehavior that is attributed to the individuals and punishes the good deeds of well-intentioned people who are trying hard to do the right thing. And I think we need to, looking at that institutional framework, we can understand a lot more of why things like police brutality and racial profiling persist than if we just try to look at the moral faults of the individuals involved. And also, I mean, that then leads to the next question of, well, if the institutions are arranged in these ways that promote these abuses, who benefits from that? And once we start looking at who benefits and who suffers, I think we really see the political implications of what the police are doing.
You can listen to the entire interview with Christian Williams on our April 7th program. To learn more about Our Enemies in Blue, you can visit the website of the book's publisher, Soft Skull Press. In November 2004, Whitehall, Wisconsin police officer Daniel Wineski was sentenced to 7 years in prison for sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl, Alicia Rodriguez, in his squad car in 1996. Shortly after reporting this, I began to receive emails from Terry Miles, who claimed he knew a lot more about Wineski. After several months of correspondence, it became apparent that Miles had been following the Wineski story for many years. Miles was familiar with alleged sexual assaults by Wineski going back to the 80s. It was also obvious and eventually reported in the local media that Miles had been largely responsible for the fact that Wineski had been charged in the first place through several decades of persistent contact with media outlets and local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies. We featured an interview with Miles on our February 3rd program.
Her son had been pulled over and arrested for drunk driving and possession of marijuana, and the very next night, Wineski started following her home from work. Well, at the end of the week, Wineski pulled her over and walks up to the car, and he goes, you know, your son's in a lot of trouble. He could be facing prison time, probably get a couple years out of it, and I've got a speeding ticket here for you, but I can take care of everything for a blowjob. That's when I realized that it never stopped, and I thought, well, my God, this started in the early 1980s. It's been almost 20 years. And when I got back home, I started calling up friends of mine from high school and saying, hey, you know, do you remember all that stuff Wineski did with the girls back in the 80s? I'm like, yeah. And I said, well, he's still doing it. I said, we got to start talking to somebody and put an end to this. Then I sent a package down to the Division of Criminal Investigation to a man named David Collins. What I did not know was that he was originally from Trempealeau County. He had started out with the Trempealeau County Sheriff's Department. Whitehall is the county seat.
Okay.
So the Whitehall Police Department and the Trempealeau County Sheriff's Department share facilities. Now, this David Collins is in charge of white-collar crime for the entire state. He's the one that decides whether or not crooked cops are going to be investigated, then he hands the cases to the agents. So I send the whole thing down to him after talking to him on the phone for probably 45 minutes. And he told me that just from talking to me on the phone, I did not have a case. He said, do you hear this? There's a loud thump. And he goes, that's your package going in the garbage. I'm not even going to waste my time opening it up. Then I contacted the FBI. They said that I could not file complaints on behalf of the women. I had to find at least one woman that would come forward and do it herself. I talked to several of them, and they told me no, simply because they're scared. So I figured I got to come up with some way that after having wiped myself out financially, moving across the state and doing this for 3 years, there's got to be some basically really inexpensive way to get things moving. So I waited until August 2003, and that's when I handed out flyers.
Sorry, you said you handed out flyers?
That's during the parade to all the people on the sidewalk in Whitehall watching the parade during Beef and Dairy Days. And the flyer reads like this. Hi, my name's Terry Miles. I'm working to make Trempealeau County a better place to live. Do you have a problem or complaint about law enforcement or the judicial system in Trempealeau County? Do you have knowledge of misconduct or illegal activity by law enforcement or courthouse personnel? Abusing power or authority for personal gain to get money, drugs, or sex? Misappropriation or misuse of money and property? Excessive or unnecessary use of force? Law enforcement not responding to calls? Law enforcement taking hours or even days to arrive at the scene of an incident. Intimidating or threatening victims and witnesses. Refusal to investigate or take statements. Using drugs and alcohol while working or on duty. And then I went on to explain that I lived there for 32 years and this can't be allowed to go on. Well, I handed out about 400 of these.
When Officer Wineski was sent to prison last November, he had pleaded guilty to sexually assaulting Alicia Rodriguez when she was 14 years old in 1996. In January, Rodriguez filed a lawsuit against Wineski, the city of Whitehall, and others, alleging, among other things, that Wineski violated her civil rights when he held a gun to her head and threatened to kill her and her family if she ever told anyone about the sexual assault. Her lawsuit was settled in July, and I spoke with Rodriguez shortly afterwards.
In 99, when I became pregnant with my first child, is when I decided I needed to tell somebody about what had happened. Just, you know, I didn't know how I was going to be able to deal with the pregnancy and everything with the emotional toll that the Wineski assault was taking on me. So I wrote a letter to a social worker, and I didn't hear anything back from him, so I kind of just concluded on my own that he either didn't believe me or he didn't get the letter. It was, oh, I would say at the most about a week or so after I wrote the letter to the social worker that I approached Chief Espenson, and I told him I had to make a complaint about Wineski, and Espenson asked me if it was sexual, and I said yes, and he told me he'd come by, and, well, he didn't. When we turned in our summary of judgment, which is where both sides turns in their findings on the case and you know, we say why there's a case and the other side says why there's not, and the judge makes his ruling, and the judge, as you know, dismissed my case. It was a civil rights case, and one of his rulings was that the threat that Wineski made, you know, with his weapon under my chin was not a violation of my civil rights. Another one of his reasoning was that the statute of limitations had expired. And in a sexual assault case, when you're a minor at the time, you have until you're of the age of 30 to report it, or you get an additional 2 years after the perpetrator's in prison if he was an actual threat to you, and that's why you didn't report it. So either way, I fell between those statutes because I'm not 30, and obviously Wineski has not been in prison for 2 years. But he ruled on an old statute because the original statute was just 6 years from the time of the crime, which would have put me past the statutes. But in 97, the legislator changed the statute to what I had just explained, and he didn't pay any attention to that. And when that was brought to the defense's attention, they already were aware that the judge had made a mistake. So we were all very confident that we would win on appeal. I'm pretty confident that had that decision come this last week instead of the week before, that we would have walked away with a larger settlement. But ultimately it changed gears when that decision came, and I had to make a decision if I wanted to go through the appeal process or get it done, because like I've stated, it's not about the amount of money. You know, I needed to make it very well noted that this cannot be tolerated or accepted, and I also had to work on getting my life back.
When Officer Wineski was first brought up on the sexual assault charge against Rodriguez, 8 other women came forward to testify against him who also had been sexually abused by the officer. Wineski's guilty plea made their testimony unnecessary, but it does leave open the possibility that Wineski may be brought up on other charges in the future. You can hear the entire interview with Rodriguez on our August 25th program. In July, we featured an interview with Michelle Druyan, which focused on the misconduct committed by her husband, LAPD Officer Scott Druyan. At the time that our interview was broadcast, Druyan was facing termination from his job because of an on-duty sexual relationship. His wife also accused him of beating her on more than one occasion. Our investigation revealed that domestic violence charges were never filed against the officer.
He, in fact, was receiving oral sex on duty, was frequenting the nude strip bar that was within his division, him and a partner, using their badges and uniforms to get in for free, and were actually customers during their duty. They each met one of these strippers and started affairs, and it would protect each other and cover for each other, and it was all going on duty. They'd go to an abandoned lot that was being prepared for construction, and they worked nights, so it was very late, off of the main highway, and do their business there and cover for each other. It was the end of August when I actually called the internal affairs. I wanted to save my marriage, foolishly thinking that, and believing, because then I was told it was just this one random incident and it would never happen again. I knew the second I did it, it was the biggest mistake I ever made, and so on and so on. And I really wanted to try and save my marriage, so I didn't go to internal affairs, and I probably should have, but I wanted to try to save my marriage and didn't think turning him in would do anything to benefit that cause, so I didn't. But I did tell him that I would if he continued lying to me, that was the one contingency that I could not live with. All other problems I would learn to deal with, and we could get counseling for all of our issues and things like that, but I would not stay if he continued to lie, and that meant lying about anything. But I then found out another very big lie, which came from the wife of the other officer, because we had started talking by then. I had informed her. She had 2 children, and I felt that it was a safety issue that she should get tested for STDs. And I had debated for a month, really beat myself up over whether or not to contact her, but I finally felt that that was important, that she should be notified. And so we had kind of had a dialogue and shared information as we'd find out. And this was the last straw. I found out that it wasn't one time. It was multiple times. I found out that Scott was the instigator. My husband was the one that had suggested all of this in the first place. And that was it. I had had it. I just couldn't take anymore. And at that point, turned him in. Well, he had been suspended already. He was suspended, or, well, what they called assigned to home, based on the admin charges, which were signing in and out false time, signing his in and out sheets. He had fallen asleep on duty one day while he was in the watchtower watching the recruits on the shooting range. He had fallen asleep, and one day he failed to show up or call in and repeated late to start duty. Those were the four things. Those were the four admin charges that he was already assigned a home for.
At the time we broadcast that interview, Scott Druyan remained employed by the LAPD, and other than this program, the story had received no media attention whatsoever. Within days of the broadcast, Officer Druyan had resigned. Since that time, Michelle Druyan has told her story to the LA Times, Fox News, ABC News, and others. The LA County District Attorney's Office says that they are having another look at whether or not to charge Druyan with beating his wife. You can listen to the entire interview with Michelle Druyan on our July 7th program. Critical mass riots across North America have been the focus of a great deal of unwanted attention from the police. Critical mass is a loose collective of bicycle activists who gather for monthly rides in more than 200 cities and towns in the United States and Canada. In June, we featured an interview originally broadcast by Free Radio Santa Cruz after police in Sacramento, California, attacked a critical mass ride there and arrested several people.
And so the cop comes out of his car, grabs the guy, subdues him for a few minutes, and just holds him there for a few minutes. He wasn't even talking to him. Like, I was standing right there, you know, asking him what he's doing. Like, is he being detained? Is he being arrested? You know, what's the situation? You know, and there was others, like, totally standing up for the guy, you know, and questioning the cop. The cop wasn't saying anything at all, just asking us to get back and get away from the car.
It's still the one officer?
It was just one officer at this point. You know, okay. Pretty quickly, officers started coming. But for a good, like, let's say even 5 minutes, there was just this one cop, the same cop that was following us, the same cop who made that protest in the very beginning. And then he kept changing his story, and he's like, yes, he is being charged, he's being arrested. What's he being charged with? I don't know yet. You know, he might just be detained. He just keeps changing his story back and forth. The cop car, I mean, the light's changing green, red. He's doing a better job of blocking traffic than he said that we were. And then a lot of other cops started coming. Like, I remember there's these two bike cops started coming, and then once all these other cops started coming, they started getting out their batons. They were getting out taser guns. They never actually used the taser guns, but they were getting them out as like a threat, it seemed like. They were getting out pepper spray and never actually used the pepper spray. But what I'm basically trying to say is they were getting all these like threatening weapons, trying to pose some type of threat to get everybody off of the street. And pretty quickly after cops started coming, the second person was technically, I shouldn't say arrested, because there's only two of us arrested. The other two were actually just detained and then later cited. So the next guy that was actually grabbed by the police was the first, I think, of four that was really handled. I mean, the first guy, he was grabbed and then just pulled over the car. So there wasn't any real brutality there. But this second guy, again, I was right in that area. The guy, you know, totally grabs his arm, twists it around, and pulls it around. And so from what I saw, he was the first guy who was really brutally handled, you know. There was nobody getting on the bullhorn saying, you know, okay, this is what's going to happen. I need you all to clear out of the street or else I'm going to start making arrests. Or this is what's going to happen. I need you all to continue the ride or be on the bike lane or be in one lane or else I'm going to start making arrests or anything like that. It was just this chaotic scene of this first person being arrested and this rookie cop being this catalyst to, like, it was almost as like he inspired all these other cops who came later on just start like To be violent, basically, for no reason whatsoever.
You can find out more about Critical Mass at www.critical-mass.org. You can listen to that entire interview on our June 2nd program. In Vancouver, British Columbia, a group of people have come together to create a website where people can report cases of abuse and misconduct committed by Vancouver police officers. I came across the website by accident before its official launch and arranged an interview with one of its creators.
We saw problems with the official police complaints process as being more of a whitewashing process than an actual investigative, transparent process. So the site is something that we intend to be unfiltered information about what is actually going on as far as people's problems with the police. So it's kind of a clearinghouse of people's telling the story of their own problems with being abused by the police without mediation by an institution. So the process is people go to the website, register for an account, submit their incident, and then we go through and we approve any incidents that aren't basically people trying to sabotage the site. So we don't edit the submissions and we don't vote for whether they're true or not. It's like Indie Media, it's a clearinghouse for people to tell their stories. And if people want to be more credible, they can reveal more about who they are. But we allow for anywhere from anonymous submissions to people giving names, addresses, and phone numbers. So people have the opportunity to identify themselves if they feel that would be valuable to their credibility, or they can remain anonymous. So we're providing a forum, but we're not vouching for whether everything on the form is true. But we're hoping that by the very volume of the incidents that we receive, that we're able to convey what's going on. There's no plans for any advocacy, but we do have links on the site to advocacy groups such as Pivot and the BC Civil Liberties Union, and encourage people to go to them for advocacy. We're kind of trying to add one piece of the total puzzle, but not replace other pieces that are already there. We're planning on doing a press release to about 600 reporters, as well as a sticker campaign to get people aware of it. So right now we've got it on. It's starting to get used a little bit by the community, but we hope to penetrate the mainstream with it. The URL, just so I don't forget, is www.worklessparty.org/VPD. And the reason that it's hosted on the Workless Party's site is that they were able to provide us with anonymous hosting. They're partnering with us to provide that.
A Canadian Press Wire story was published in newspapers across Canada in August announcing the arrival of the Vancouver Police Complaints website. To hear that entire interview, listen to our June 23rd program. In April, we broadcast an interview from Co-op Radio in Vancouver about plans to arm Vancouver Transit Police with guns.
If there were a compelling justification for the need for that kind of armament, then that would be fine by us. Our concern here is that we have not heard a compelling justification. We've heard, well, we're making them police, ergo they must be armed. So that just begs the question, let's back up a step and ask why we need to make them police. Certainly, if there was the kind of violence on the SkyTrain that we could see the need for, what we're talking about here is the potential for lethal force to be dispensed. That level of violence would be a justification. We haven't heard that that's the problem. We have the new chief constable, I think is Mr. Kind, of the special police force that's being created here, and that's the justification we've heard from him. I haven't heard any further on that. What they're doing is they're bringing in legislation to make them special constables, and that would bring them under the Police Act. So they would, in fact, become peace officers in the sense that the legislation acknowledges.
Are they set up like regular police?
Well, they aren't. They are in many ways, and one of the ways that we think that the new situation will, in fact, be an improvement is it will bring the complaints process under the Police Act, and that will ultimately bring it under the jurisdiction of the Office of the Police Complaints Commissioner, which is an independent body from the police to accept public complaints. So that's very good, because up till now, if you have a complaint about transit security, it goes into a black hole. It's an internal process. There's no public accountability there. So that's a good thing. The thing that we're concerned about in terms of the accountability process, though, is with police, the standard of accountability is what's called civilian oversight. That would be your basic police board made up of non-police who oversee the detachment. Well, in this case, the police board is made up entirely of police. And I have heard no justification for why we have no civilian oversight of this special unit.
Transit police officers in Vancouver are now armed with guns. You can listen to that entire interview on our April 7th program. The Toronto police made an overt attempt to mend poor relations with Toronto's gay community during Pride Week celebrations this year. The new police chief, Bill Blair, hosted a Pride Week reception and marched in the big parade. The night before the parade, several Toronto police officers are accused of beating Amir Ebrahimnia, the owner of a bar in the gay village, for 15 minutes after an alcohol inspection. The beating received absolutely no mainstream media attention.
I took my mom downstairs from the second floor to first floor, laid her down on a couch, and she didn't look well. I looked at two of the officers standing by the door. And there was a female officer. I looked directly at her and I said, "Can you please get us some help? Dial 911. Right? My mom needs medical attention." She looked at me for like a split second. She's like, "You know, you have a phone. You dial 911. Right? So that was a response. I was like, "Fine. You know what? I got no time to even think about this right now." I go running to the first floor behind a bar, pick up a telephone. I dialed 911. And regular questions, ambulance, fire, police. I'm like, "I need an ambulance. What's wrong, sir?" I told her what's wrong. I said, "You know, 60-year-old woman, she's down. We think it's a stroke. She's having trouble breathing." And I gave the address. And as I was doing that, the police officers, they started moving back in again. Right? So picture this. I'm standing behind a bar. My mom would be at my 11 o'clock on the couch. The door that they're coming from is like 12:30. And there's a wall on my 4 o'clock. So as I'm on the phone, I see them walking in to grab my mom and push her out.
Oh.
That's when I freaked out. I started yelling at the police officers. "You know what? Just get the fuck out. You've done
and
enough. You've done your job." I'm on the phone with 911 at the time. And I whipped the martini shaker at the wall at my 4 o'clock. As soon as I whipped the martini shaker, that was the moment that they were waiting for all along. Now, that's when I was still on the phone with 911. I told them, I said, "You know what? Just get the fuck out, blah, blah, blah." You know, I was yelling at them. I threw the martini shaker at the wall. That's when they ran over. And by that point, I dropped the phone and I was pummeled. Like, they beat me for about 15 minutes. Like, I lost track of time. My staff members, they were all there. And they came to help me out. Well, they tried to say something or do something, but the police just pushed them aside. Even I had a couple of my staff members say, "Listen, we're witnessing this. We're witnessing this." And they just said, "You know what? Get the fuck out." Kick them all out. And they continued. See, I thought at first that what's happening is they're just going to jump on top of me. They're just going to jump on top of me and handcuff me. That's what I was expecting. I went down. I put my hand behind me. But that's not what happened. I got punched in the head several times. I had a gentleman who kept on stomping my face while another guy grabbed me by the hair and started smashing my head on the ground, right? And I could hear them like saying, "Oh, you had to be a fucking smartass, didn't you?" And several times I heard them say, "Stop resisting arrest, stop resisting arrest." And I kept on screaming. I said, "I'm not resisting arrest. I'm not resisting arrest."
On July 4th, the week after Pride, the Toronto Police Service issued a media release announcing their attempt to recruit police officers from within Toronto's gay communities. Several investigations of Ebrahimnia's accusations are currently underway. You can listen to the entire interview on our July 7th program. In May, we featured an interview with Min-Suk Lee, writer and director of the documentary film Hogtown, The Politics of Policing. The interview was originally broadcast on the CKLN program Cinephobia.
Hogtown, The Politics of Policing is a verite documentary that looks at how political pressures impact politicians and how politics affects policing in our city, in the city of Toronto. And it was shot during a six-month period of time in which policing became very central to the city on a number of fronts. One, there were a series of shootings in the city, in the streets, where people then were reacting to that and felt that there has to be some kind of citywide solutions or There has to be some kind of thinking through on what's going on with the shootings in the streets of Toronto. So there was an environment in which many people were talking about the recent flare-up of shootings on the streets, and people were talking from different ranges. Some people were talking about, you know, guns and gangs, more cops. We need more cops and more money to the cops. And then other people were saying, well, you know, community services have been so defunded that it's not a surprise. Like, look at the bigger picture. And this kind of polarization and different solutions towards a very critical problem in our city is what my camera captured. But then, and it's interesting about the guns and the shooting in the city in that our homicide rate and our violent crime rate has gone down. We're one of the safest cities in North America and in the world. But shootings, when they occur, they seize the headline. People get very scared, and there can be, and often there is, an attitude where, you know, more law and order, more cops in the streets. The policing is the largest budget item in the city of Toronto. We spend more on policing than we do on fire and ambulances, parks and recreation, senior services, children's services combined. So Hogtown followed the whole budget process, a tug of war around that. And there was an environment of a lot of acrimony, and certain police services board members talked about feeling intimidated or that they were concerned about being surveilled. That whole environment is captured in Hogtown. And then, in the midst of shooting, the largest police corruption scandal in Canadian history flared up. And two sons of the former chief of police of Toronto, of a former chief of police, were charged, one with Police Service Act violations and another one with criminal charges. In total, I think in 2004, just over 20 police officers were charged with various offenses. And during the time of my shooting, a series of these charges hit the headlines. So then the camera captured the time when the Police Services Board had to develop a response. And citizens were asking, you know, what's going on with police and who are the police overseers and when is there any governance of policing? And these kinds of questions that really test the mettle of democracy. And finally, sort of at the end of my process of shooting, the police chief at the time, Julian Fantino, his contract was not renewed. And when the Police Services Board, which makes that decision, announced that decision, that kicked off a firestorm of a political debate, both on council floor but also in the streets of Toronto. And it was very interesting to see how that debate was languaged and how people took sides on that and how it became very politicized. That, in a nutshell, is Hogtown.
In January, Toronto police officers attacked and arrested peaceful protesters at York University. On our March 17th program, we featured an interview produced by Charlotte Scott.
The demonstration was just about to wrap up when six officers from the Toronto Police's Division 31, which is a division known for the abuses that it commits against black youth living around where York University is located, especially around the Jane Finch community. So these cops came in, and within about 2 minutes of their arriving on the scene, they began attacking the protesters. The first person who was knocked down was the person who was using the megaphone, and students were extremely upset to be seeing their friend being beaten by the cops. At least one person sort of like was trying to hold on to this, to the first protester who was being beaten by the police. And then the police started beating the people who were trying to hold on to him and prevent him from being beaten. In total, I saw at least two people being hit by the police. There was no violence on the part of the protesters against the police. I did see the police, one police officer saying, you have to leave. But they only gave 2 minutes. That was 2 minutes before they started attacking people. And not everybody heard them say that. This was all in plain view of the York community. This is a very central location on the York campus. After they had beaten a couple of students and arrested a few students, they started dragging those they'd arrested down a hall. And we heard the police officers saying, now what room was it again? What room are we bringing them to? But this indicated that there had been some kind of provision made between York security and the police. And this is very concerning to those of us who are members of the York community, because it implies that the university set aside a room for the police to interrogate students. There was no need for that. They could have just brought the people that they had arrested out to a car. But in the first place, there was no need for the police to come onto campus. There was no damage that was being inflicted or no threat to either property or people at York. So it's a big question as to why the administration decided to let the police come onto the campus.
William Connell, a police officer in East Rochester, New York, has been accused in two lawsuits of brutally attacking two women. These cases were brought to my attention in a series of emails from a friend of one of the women brutalized by the officer. In May, we featured an interview with Christina Agola, the lawyer representing both of the women.
In or about the second week of October, Teresa Arenas, who is a 47-year-old daycare provider who has no criminal record whatsoever, was at a local tavern with a bunch of friends and her sister. When she exited the bar to have a cigarette, she was immediately tackled by a gentleman who we now know as Officer Connell. She was body slammed to the ground. She was virtually lifted off of the ground and slammed to the ground in front of approximately 10 to 15 witnesses. Eight of those witnesses we already have under oath in sworn statements who corroborate what I just recited, that she was actually body slammed out of nowhere by this officer, placed into handcuffs, face down to the ground. She was screaming for help. The crowd became enraged. They were basically screaming, you know, she didn't do anything. Leave her alone. Stop. The officer called for backup from the Monroe County Sheriff's Department. I think because he felt cornered, you know, I think he felt afraid of the crowd. In any event, the Sheriff's Department did arrive, and Ms. Arenas was lifted off the ground, put into the back of the police car, eventually taken to the emergency room of a local hospital, and suffered blunt trauma to her left shoulder, which was a rotator cuff surgery site for which she's, you know, undergone physical therapy for, and underwent some great psychic trauma over that event, I think as anybody would. Hyman is a intellectually challenged, mentally disabled female, 24 years old. She's on Social Security disability. She lives with her mother. We received a phone call that Hyman had been placed into jail after she was tasered on her breasts and vagina. And I said, well, can't be. So I went over to the jail and I said, what happened? And she told me the story that on one evening, February 2nd, she had contacted the police because she feared that her ex-boyfriend was attempting to sexually assault her. Police came to the scene. They went to interview the alleged harasser. They came back 15 minutes later and told her, we don't believe you. From that point forward, the stories conflict. Her story is that they began to throw snowballs at her and basically were calling her a fucking idiot and this and that. Connell then followed her into her apartment building, grabbed her by the back of the neck. She fell over a bench that was in the hallway. She was on her back. He mounted her, essentially, had his knee in her sternum. Ms. Hyman, as a sidebar, is about 120 pounds, 5'5". Connell is about 300 pounds, 5'11". He then proceeded to taser her in the stun gun mode, what we call drive stun, right above her labia, on her inner thigh. He then lifted her shirt up and then shot her on the breast.
Although this story has been reported in the local media, details like the alleged taser abuse have been completely ignored. Two new lawsuits have been filed in the case by the plaintiffs and their witnesses who allege continuing harassment from Officer Connell and other East Rochester police officers. You can hear the entire interview with Christina Agola on our May 5th program. In March, we featured our first in an ongoing series of interviews dealing with tasers. Robert Bagnell died in June 2004 after he was shocked with a taser by Vancouver police who were responding to a call for medical assistance. We spoke to his sister, Patty Gilman, twice this year about her brother's death and her growing doubts about the safety of the devices.
On the 23rd of July, they told us on the 25th of June that he had died on the 23rd of June. So exactly a month later, on the 23rd of July, the Vancouver police held a news conference to advise the public that they had used a taser on my brother. it took them a month to disclose that information. I got an email from a friend who said that he had seen something on the news and that I should probably watch the news. So we watched it with the rest of Canada on CBC News. We had no idea what a taser was until then, and we've sure learned a lot since then. We were horrified. It was an awful, awful thing to find out, and especially to find it out in that way. Not to have been told by the police personally, you know, beforehand that they were going to announce this. It was devastating. 3 weeks after that, after the first news conference, they held a second news conference to suddenly advise that at the time of the incident, there was a fire in the Continental Hotel where my brother lived. And they said that the fire made the use of the taser more urgent and that what had started out as an arrest had actually turned into a rescue operation, and they had to rescue him from this supposedly burning building. And meanwhile, witnesses have told us that the fire was a small electrical one in a first-floor apartment and that it was quickly extinguished and 90% of the people that lived there did not evacuate. We don't have any details from them yet. All we have is sort of from what witnesses have said. They've said that he was having what appeared to be a seizure and required medical assistance. And apparently the person at the hotel front desk called for medical assistance and the police instead arrived first. And I think that has a lot to do with the address of the building,
Yeah. The
downtown east side. And I think that's just, you know, the first response is send the police.
You can hear the entire interview with Patty Gilman on our March 17th program. A date has still not been set for an inquest into her brother's death. We also spoke with a highly regarded electrical standards engineer named James Ruggieri, whose research points to significant flaws in the claims made by Taser International, the manufacturer of the weapon. Ruggieri has accused the company of making false claims about the safety of their products, and he says they misapplied electrical standards to make their weapons appear safe. He also found other researchers who claimed that people could suffer heart attacks many hours after receiving an electric shock. When a coroner in Chicago cited a taser as a cause of death in a case in Chicago last month, he acknowledged Ruggieri's influence.
There were two separate researchers in published medical journals, peer-reviewed medical journals, that came up with those findings with respect to the delayed onset of ventricular fibrillation. It was related to low voltage. When I say low voltage, meaning generally voltage under 600 volts, in these particular cases that the researchers evaluated, there happened to have been line current, residential line voltage of about 120 volts. And what they found in one researcher's case is that he had three individuals who presented symptoms following low voltage shock across the thoracic region that culminated delayed ventricular fibrillation. In one case, it was up to 12 hours following exposure of an individual to electric shock. So when you have ventricular fibrillation, what's happening is that the two lower quadrants are quivering. They're not syncopated with the top two, which are the atrium quadrants, that supply blood to the ventricles. So blood doesn't flow. You have inadequate perfusion of the human tissue because the ventricles are quivering. They're not cooperating with each other. It's sort of like milking a cow. You have to guide the blood from one segment to the next. When the ventricles are fibrillating or shaking uncooperatively, what happens is that blood doesn't pump not only to the human tissue, the arms, the head, but to the heart itself. So the heart is starved for oxygenated blood, and that generally manifests in what's known as a heart attack. 50,000 or 50 kilovolts is quite a large voltage. Generally, one doesn't see those type of voltage aside from perhaps static electricity or lightning. Typically, it's transmission voltage. Of course, transmission voltages can go well in excess of that. But 50,000 volts is not something that the average individual will see day to day. That's quite a bit of voltage. Generally, the cattle prods are less voltage. 50,000 volts, as provided by the taser, sits on the high end of the scale for electroshock devices. Cattle prods, depending on the units that are available, it does vary from manufacturer to manufacturer. Typically, they can range from 2,000 volts to perhaps 10,000 volts. It's rare that you see anything beyond 15,000 volts. Well, I suspect that Taser's rationale for the high voltage is to overcome the impedance of clothing. Generally, when you're dealing with a cattle or an animal, they do have fur, but they don't have the type of clothing that one might see, particularly in the winter climates, of coats and perhaps vests, shirts, T-shirts. Those are relatively insulating materials, and when asked about the need for the high voltage, Taser has always proffered the intention of the need to break down the insulating barrier provided by clothing. Certainly one would need a lot less voltage to do what the Taser does.
You can listen to the entire interview with James Ruggieri on our March 24th program. Anne-Marie Cusick is an investigative journalist at The Progressive magazine. On our April 21st program, we spoke with her about her article, The Trouble with Tasers.
In 1998, the company started something else, which it called Project Stealth. And it began to develop a taser with higher power. By higher power, I mean higher wattage. And the early tasers had about 5 watts of power. The air taser, I believe, had about 7 watts. But they started to really up the amount of wattage in a taser. And the reason that they wanted to do this was to bring about something called electromuscular disruption. I talked to a doctor who said that there's a certain point at about 14 watts where you get this electromuscular disruption, which means that the muscles in the body start to constrict. And the person is unable to resist and so falls on the ground. Part of the point for Taser International, according to its advertising material, in doing this was to get around the problems that tasers were. I mean, if you talk to police officers in the earlier part, the mid-90s, they would say, well, the taser doesn't always work. You know, if someone is mentally ill or on drugs or sometimes even on alcohol or just has strong willpower, they can withstand the taser and come at you anyway. And so there was a lot of, I guess I would call, skepticism about these weapons. And what Taser did was, by upping the wattage, they got around that problem. At least that's what they claim. They're named after their wattage. The X26 is higher power, but also light. It's easy to carry. I've tried many, many times to talk to Taser International, and the company did ask me to submit a list of questions by email, which I did, but they didn't talk to me. So I'm getting what I know from news reports, from the company advertising, and they have a very extensive website, and from discussions with law enforcement. They certainly responded to a perceived need, and these devices are very popular among law enforcement. And if people die after use of a taser, there can be many reasons for it. Some of the people were on cocaine, as the company points out. Some of the people were restrained physically, and some of the people may have had pre-existing conditions. It's really difficult to wade through some of that. Now, there are a number of coroners who have listed the taser as a contributing factor, and in those cases, I think you do have to wonder about those companies' claims.
On our March 31st program, we featured an interview with Chris Ford from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals about their concerns with the planned University of Wisconsin Taser study. The U.S. Department of Justice has spent $500,000 to fund the study.
Dr. Webster plans to take 30 pigs. He's going to induce them with cocaine and then taser them to determine whether or not tasers are safe to use on people. After he's done tasering and giving the pigs cocaine, then he's going to kill them and perform autopsies on them.
How does this answer questions about tasers exactly?
You know, that's a really good question. We're not exactly sure. You know, there's a lot of differences between humans and pigs. And in fact, a similar experiment like this has already been done at least on four separate occasions. So on every occasion, you know, the experimenters found that tasers were safe to use on pigs. The problem is that, you know, there's 103 people who passed away after being tasered, which shows that tasers aren't necessarily, you know, safe to use on humans. Basically, what Dr. Webster is trying to prove is that tasers do not affect the heart, that they only affect, that it affects the skin and that it affects the skeletal system of people, but it does not affect the heart and that it does not affect the brain, I believe, is what he's also trying to prove. So that would go to show that, you know, the people that have died after being tasered, that their deaths were not a direct result of tasers, especially the ones that died of suffering of a heart arrhythmia. So I should point out that Dr. Webster does already think that tasers are safe to use on people. So what he's planning to do with this experiment is just to prove his own conclusions that tasers are safe.
Two significant stories emerged after we broadcast this interview. A taser employee was listed as a consultant on the study by Dr. Watson. It was also discovered that two prior Taser International studies on pigs failed to get required approval from various U.S. government departments. That's all for Bad Cop, No Donut this week. Tune in next week for part two of our special first anniversary programming. Next week, we'll have a look at some of the controversy that this program generated in the past year. Feel free to send in your comments and story ideas. The email address for this program is ron@ckln.fm. Bad Cop No Donut is produced at CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto and can be heard in Syracuse, New York on WXXE 90.5 FM and in Great Barrington, Massachusetts on WBCR 97.7 FM. I'm Ron Anisich, and I'm looking forward to bringing you many new interviews in our second year.